When did you come to the United States?
August 24th, 1937.
And where did you come to?
To Chicago.
Why did you come to Chicago?
Because my dad had a brother there who signed the papers for us to come to the United States because of the Hitler situation.
Who else came with you?
My sister. She was 4.5 years older than I am. And we came and we lived with my aunt and uncle. And a year later, thank God, my parents were able to get out. And they came in September of 1938. And we lived with my aunt and uncle until our furniture came. And then we got an apartment for my sister, my mother and dad, and myself. And being refugees, it was very hard. My dad had a hard time finding a job, but he did get one job after another. Of course, not speaking the language was very difficult. But then eventually the job didn't last. And because of the language barrier, then finally he decided, well, we have to eat. And so we started to sell eggs. And my mother made homemade noodles. And my dad, my sister, she had a job. She worked and as a bookkeeper. But I was still going to school. I was only 12 years old. And I was going to school. But before I went to school in the morning, I would go and peddle eggs and noodles around the neighborhood. And my dad, he did it on a full-time basis. And we did that for several years. And then finally, a few years later, he did find a job with a dress manufacturer. But those were very, very tough times. But we survived, we worked day and night, and we just tried to keep our head above water. And whatever my sister would pitch in, whatever she made, she helped with the family, and whatever I did, I helped with the family, because we had to survive. My mother made noodles during the day, and at night when we came home, we all helped. We had a big apartment, we had noodles spread out throughout the house, drying, and then my mother had a noodle machine, and she cut them, and we'd package them at night, and the next day we would sell them.
What was your father's first job before he was in the noodle and the egg business?
He worked for a short time for Walgreens Drug in the shipping department, but that didn't last very long. Then he helped my uncle, who was in the meat business. He was a butcher. They had butcher shops, and he helped a little bit there, but that was not enough to sustain us, to keep us going. So then that's when he decided, well, we had to do something to make a living and to keep us going. So then that's when he decided to sell the eggs, and my mother said, well, she would make noodles, and that was it.
Did he go to school to learn English? How did he learn English?
I think he went to night school for a few months, but nothing really. You finally learn the language when you have to speak it. I mean, sure, it was much harder for him and for my mother, especially my mother even more so, because she was in the house all the time, you know. But my dad, he learned. I mean, he didn't speak a perfect English, but he managed to get by. And by the time, maybe 5 years later, I mean, he was able to, you know, do very well. And my mother, too, learned their language. I mean, they both. Of course, German still was the language that we spoke at home. It was still our mother tongue. Until today, I still speak a lot of German, even though my present husband isn't German. But I still come out, and I do speak a lot of German with my children. They all speak German, so it's just an instinct that, you know. So, we worked very hard. We had a rough life, and then when I was 15, I lied about my age, and I got a job as a soda jerk at Walgreens. My cousin's uncle was one of the vice presidents, so I did get a job there and worked there after school and evenings as a soda jerk. And then went to school during the day, went to high school, and then I went to Jones Commercial School, which was a secretarial school, which was downtown, and then after that they got jobs for us. So then I worked for Brunswick Balky after school and worked there until I graduated. Continued to work there until 1940, I believe it was, or 41.
What was your first job like at Walgreens? What did you do?
I was a soda jerk, making sodas and ice cream sandwiches behind the counter.
How many hours did you work then?
Maybe 20, 25, besides going to school. And then I worked as a clerk for National Tea after that. Worked on Saturdays and after school too, after I left Walgreens, because I think I got a few more cents. So I worked there. And then after I stayed with Brunswick Balky for 2 years, and then I figured I wasn't getting enough money, so then I quit the job, and my parents were very upset with me. They said, "How can you quit a job when you don't have anything else?" I said, "I will find something," because I had enough bookkeeping experience. And so I finally got a job with the American Jewish Congress as a head bookkeeper in Chicago, and I worked there until I got married, which was in September 1946.
And what did that job consist of?
I was in charge of all the accounting work. We had an auditor, but I was the head bookkeeper for the American Jewish Congress, keeping the accounts straight and getting memberships and associates. And it was a lot of work, but I enjoyed it. I worked as many hours as I could to get even extra overtime, even though the other girls would quit when 5 o'clock came around. If I could put in a few extra hours, I did.
Were you supporting yourself at that time?
Whatever money I made, I would give my parents the money. My father would give me an allowance to cover my train expenses and maybe a little bit of spending money. So everything that I made all these years, we always turned it over to our parents to help them survive.
Were you expected to work?
Absolutely. We didn't know anything different. We had to keep going. And in those days, you had to work. There was no other way out. I mean, you had to pay rent, you had to pay utilities, telephone, clothing, and you just didn't know anything different but to work and eat and sleep. And sure, on the weekends, I would go to the Point, which was the beach. I had a lot of friends. But our main objective in life really was to get ahead and to work.
Did your father work 7 days a week, eight days a week? How much did he work?
No, when he worked for himself, I mean, he would work and very seldom. I mean, if he worked, he didn't work on Shabbos because my parents were religious. But he would work on Sunday, and I would work on Sunday. Even when we were selling eggs, I would go to further places away to people that our customers, and I would take the streetcar and deliver some eggs and noodles. And so I would say we worked 6 days a week.
Did your mother ever work outside the house?
No, except she made the noodles, which was really a full-time job besides keeping the house in order.
All day long?
All day long.
What about your sister?
My sister always worked out of the home. She had learned English in Germany. And like I said, she was older, so she worked. When we first came here, she worked for my uncle as a cashier in the butcher shop. She made $2 a week. That was for herself. And then she had anything that we needed, if we needed our shoes repaired or a haircut or whatever. No, I didn't get a haircut because I had braids, long braids, so I didn't have my haircut. But she had to pay out of the $2 a week. She had to pay for me if I wanted something. If I wanted ice cream cone, then she would give me a nickel. She still has the record today of when I gave Carola a nickel for an ice cream cone. And she has always been very accurate, and she always kept records of everything. So she still has, every once in a while she'll throw that up to me. She says, I got it written down where I gave you a nickel for an ice cream cone. But she worked after my parents came, then she got another job, because $2 a week was not enough. Was practically nothing, really, when you come right down to it. But they took advantage of us. I mean, I had to work the year that I was with my aunt and uncle. My cousin and her husband lived with them, and they had a child. And I was the babysitter, and I had to help do the cooking and clean the house. I had to work when I was 12 years old. From the time I've been 12 years old, I worked. So it wasn't an easy life, but thank God I'm here today to be able to tell the story. And I've survived. Work never hurts anybody.
Were your bosses Jewish?
At the American Jewish Congress, yes, of course. But Brunswick Balky, that was supposed to have been a Jewish ownership, but there were very, very few Jewish people working there. And I think I felt there was a little anti-Semitism, because that was one of the reasons that I left, because I didn't seem to get advanced the way I felt that I was capable of the work. So, and I was making, I think, $18 a week at that time. And I said, well, that's not enough. So that's when I quit. And I said, I really felt, as large a company as it was, and Benzinger's were supposed to be Jewish, but there were very, very few Jewish people employed there. So that's when I decided to leave.
Did you know any other Jews that were working there?
Maybe one or two, that's all.
Did you speak to them about your feelings that you weren't being advanced?
I don't think so, because they weren't in my department, you know, so I don't think so.
What exactly did the company do?
They are manufacturers of bowling balls and bowling shoes and billiards. The billiard tables and cues, equipment. It was a big company in Chicago. They're still in existence today. I think they're on the stock exchange today. But I mean, in those years, it was a privately held corporation, as far as I know. But even though they were Jews, there were very few Jews that worked there.
How many hours did you work a week there?
Around 40.
Did you get overtime pay?
I really don't remember. I think we did. But I think it was all on a 40-hour basis. I very seldom that we worked overtime, as far as I remember.
What was your typical day like?
Where? At work?
Yes.
It was just the routine jobs. I mean, you had your specific things that you had to do. I mean, some form of record keeping, and had to work with the adding machine, a calculator. But it was typical office work. I mean, nothing exciting or challenging. I just felt that I wasn't working to my abilities. I wasn't given the chance, you know, to do more than I really felt that I could do. And that was one of the reasons that I left.
Did you ever approach your boss and ask to be promoted?
I believe I did. And they said, well, there was no opening or some kind of an excuse. So then evidently they did probably promote. I really don't remember, but I think they probably did promote somebody else. And I just felt that I was left behind, and that was the main reason that I left.
Did you work after you were married?
No, I worked. I did all the bookkeeping for my husband. Kept all the books for him because he was in the cattle business. But other than that, I never worked outside of the home. You know, I mean, I worked, did all the book work for many, many years. And then when we went into the packing business, of course, then I worked full-time. Besides keeping the house. I did have a housekeeper after we went into the packing business.
Let's talk about your husband's work, the meat packing.
Meat packing business. Well, we started out, he too came over as a refugee, as a young boy, and his father was in the cattle business in Germany, and when they first came here, they went to Cincinnati, and he worked there as a butcher in a big meat factory, making as a sausage maker, and that only lasted for a few months. Then he had the opportunity to go to Hancock, Michigan, which was up in the copper country, way up in the sticks. My mother-in-law had a brother there. There was a small sausage factory there, and they said there was an opening there that he should come there. Well, they finally packed up, and they did move to Hancock, Michigan. But there, too, he could not speak the language, or very little. And even on the train going up to Hancock, when they took the night train, and when he woke up and he looked out the window of the train and he saw the wilderness that it was, he says, "If I don't die soon, I won't die here." So he really did not care for the country because it was a desolate place. There were hardly any Jews there. Sure, they did have family. There were a couple other refugee families there. But anyway, the job did not last that long. Then they moved from Hancock, Michigan to Iron River as another sausage maker. And then he met, in the spring of 37, he met this man from Green Bay who was visiting his daughter, a Jewish man, and he said, "Adolf, anytime you want to come to Green Bay, to a bigger community, we have lots of meat places, sausage places, you can go work for, I'll find you a job." So the next spring he did go to Green Bay, and this old man, Sam Cantor, went with him to different places. But my father-in-law was 42 years old, and every answer that he got was, "You're too old
to work in the meat factory.
To work in the, as a sausage maker, or in that type of business." So this Sam Cantor, who was a cattle dealer, he said, "Go with me in the country and see what you think." So he took him along in the country, and he came home, and he said to my mother-in-law, "What Sam Cantor knows, I have forgotten already." Because he was a cattle dealer in Germany. So he decided to go into the cattle business in Green Bay and the surrounding areas. And they bought a little truck. Well, it really was a old police van. They could put one cow in there, one or two cows. And he started to go in the country. And he really covered the territory where Bohemians, Belgians, a lot of Germans, so he was able to converse with them much easier than if he had a job where nobody could speak German. So he started in the cattle business, and unfortunately he did get sick and he did not live that long. He passed away in 1951. Then my husband was only 14 or 15. Well, then he started to help his father. And he used to go in the country before he went to school. And after school, he too had to forge his age and said he was 16 when he was actually 15, and got a driver's license and went on the road buying and selling cattle, because he grew up with that type of business. So he went into the cattle business, but then the war came. My husband had to go in the army. And my father-in-law kept the business as a cattle dealer in Green Bay. He was, and he over the years they built up quite a clientele, and the farmers all liked Adolf and they liked Ziggy. And when my husband came back from the army, he started in the cattle business again. He came back in November 45, and then he met me the following spring, and we got married in September of 1946.
I'm not really familiar with what cattle dealers do.
They buy and sell livestock. Now, some of it is for dairy. If it's for dairy, then you sell it to, you buy it from a farmer, and then you sell it to another farmer when it's used for milk. If it's a cow or a calf that is to be slaughtered, then you sell it to the packing plant where they butcher the cattle. So he did both. They handled dairy cattle as well as beef cattle.
When he went on these trips dealing, did he meet any Jews that were farmers?
No. There were no Jewish farmers that I know of in the Green Bay area. They were all Gentile people. There were other Jewish cattle dealers in the Green Bay area. But as far as any Jewish farmers, no. And then my husband and his father were together in partnership in the cattle business. And then in 1949-50, we started to buy real estate, farm real estate, and sell it again to other farmers or neighbors. And my husband, he's the one that really was the real estate broker, because his father's, the language was a barrier for him, so he couldn't pass the examination. But my husband studied for the examination, and he became a real estate broker as well as a cattle dealer.
Did they set up offices?
We had our offices in our house, because I did all the work. I did all the bookkeeping, and then any real estate transactions, I would type up all the agreements, because I've had all the experience as a bookkeeper. So, and you learn over the years. So I learned how to draft up a purchase and sales agreement, and when the time came for the closing, I would make up the closing statements and so forth. We never had any. At the end, sure, if you needed an attorney to finalize the thing, but other than that, I did all the work.
When he went out selling the cattle and the land, how far would he go on an average trip?
Oh, I would say the average territory we covered would be about 35 miles around Green Bay, in a radius of about 35 miles. His father would go in one direction. He would go east of Green Bay towards Kewaunee, Luxembourg, and where my husband, he would travel south of Green Bay. He went to Napier, Rockland, Greenleaf. That was his territory. And they tried to keep the territory split, you know. Then my brother-in-law, who also was a cattle dealer, he traveled on the west side of Green Bay. So to keep really keep peace, they had a gentleman's agreement that one would not go in each other's territory. Neither one would, you know, we wouldn't go on the west side of Green Bay, and Herbie wouldn't come in our territory.
How many other Jewish cattle dealers were there in Green Bay?
In the earlier years, there was about six cattle dealers.
How did you decide who was going to go into what area?
Well, as far as the other cattle dealers, we didn't care because we had no contact with them. I mean, we were not that close with any of them. I'm talking about my in-laws, we're not that close with any of them. My brother-in-law, who when he first came to Green Bay, was very good friends with my in-laws and my husband, and they decided if he was going to go into the cattle business, he was going to go one territory, and they would go another territory. So there was never any conflict yet.
How did the farmers pay your husband? And
we had to pay the farmers. We paid them by check or by cash. If they wanted cash, then we would pay them by cash. But we paid them. But the cattle were not the prices that they are today. For the best cow or the best heifer, you could maybe pay in the late 30s, it was maybe $20-$25 a cow. Where today, it takes a lot of money to be in the cattle business because cattle are much more expensive. But they were paid by check. Or, like I said, if they wanted cash, then we would pay them in cash. And then we would get paid again by either if we sold them to the packing plant, yes, by check, or from the farmer, we would get paid by check from the farmer that we sold the cow to.
Did you know the other Jewish families in Green Bay?
Some, sure. I didn't come to Green Bay until 1946, like I told you before, so my husband's family was there from 37 on, so they did know mostly everyone in Green Bay. There was only one synagogue, and everybody knows. There's about 100, 150 families that were there. And still today there's maybe 100, 125 families in Green Bay. They still have only one synagogue, which is great.
Were you active in the synagogue?
Yes.
What did you do?
Oh, in the first years I was not that active in. I belong to all the organizations. We have the Sisterhood in Green Bay, we have Hadassah and B'nai B'rith Women, and I was a member of all organizations, and I always held some small job. I was never really active in B'nai B'rith, but I was very active in Hadassah and the Sisterhood, so I always held some kind of treasurer or some kind of chairman. I was involved in the Jewish community as a whole. And not, like I said, not as much when my children were small because I didn't have the time, but as the children grew, of course they all went to Sunday school and the Hebrew school, they all were bar and bas mitzvah, and you have to be active in a community when that is that small. They need everybody's help. And my husband was on the board of directors of the synagogue, and after he passed away, I was on the board of directors. So we've always been involved in the Jewish community, quite active.
Was your husband involved in politics?
No. No, that he never got involved in.
What about work organizations? Was there any sort of organization that for meat, people who were dealing in meat?
No, well, I didn't finish the story. My father-in-law passed away in 1951, and then my husband continued on the business, and in 1959 he decided that he wanted to go further because it was very hard traveling, being on the road day in, day out, especially in the wintertime in Wisconsin. It's very hard, so we decided to go into the meat packing business, in other words, which is to open up a slaughterhouse to kill cattle. And we pooled all our resources that we had and decided to build a plant in Green Bay. And we went to the bank and we took everything that we had. We had acquired some real estate, which we sold, and whatever cash we could gather together, we did, and started to build, and started with a small plant. We were going to kill around 200 head of cattle a day, which we did for maybe a year, and things started to grow. Though the first 8 months, it was very, very tough. We lost lots of, practically all of our capital that we had put in, but we decided either we're going to sink or swim, and things started to turn around, and things got better, and we started to increase, and I worked full-time. I ran the office, and he ran the rest of the procurement, receiving the cattle and selling meat. We, of course, hired a lot of people, but we started out, like I said, with around, we thought we would kill around 200 cattle. By the time we finished, when we sold the plant in 1978, we were killing in Green Bay around 1,200 head of cattle a day. And the other places, an additional maybe 800, 900 head a day. So it really grew from a small plant to a big organization.
How many employees did you start with, and how many did you end with?
We started with maybe 100, and we ended up with 1,700. But we had four plants by the time we sold. We had two plants in Green Bay, one just for slaughter, and the other one was a processing plant and storage, cold storage. And then we bought another plant in 1972 in Chippewa Falls, which is 190 miles northwest of Green Bay. And there we killed about 500-600 a day. And then we bought another plant in Pampa, Texas. And there we killed about 500 a day and also processed. So we had, like I said, about 1,700 employees in total.
Who ran the plants that weren't in Green Bay?
We had plant managers. But between, I worked on a full-time basis until about 1966. We started in December of 60, and I worked full-time until then. But in the meantime, we had gotten the controllers and quite a lot of other people, you know, to help in the office, because it was just too big and I couldn't handle it. And then I had problems, physical problems, so I couldn't work full-time anymore. But I did have my hand in it. Even though I didn't work full-time, I still was involved. Oh, I would not try. I would go to the plant at least once or twice a day. I would go to the bank for them, do things that weren't that strenuous, you know, on me. But I had my hands in it.
What sort of problems came up that you might have to deal with?
Lots of problems. You had union problems, you had expansion problems with the city, with the people. It was on the outskirts, the main plant was on the outskirts of the city of Green Bay, and there were homes maybe 3-4 blocks away. They would complain of the odor from a packing plant, and there were problems constantly. From then, another big thing that was always they would see that we would go ahead, and this little Jew boy, he's trying to make it big, and he's just, so there was a lot of anti-Semitism involved as well, because we were Jewish. We always felt that there was a lot of anti-Semitism involved in the publicity that we received. Anything would go wrong. We were other companies. You had the paper mills in Green Bay. You had other businesses. If anything went wrong in their place, it was always on the inside of the paper. When Packerland had any problems, it was always the headlines or on the front page.
Do you remember any articles that might have appeared in the Green Bay papers about your plant?
Sure. lots of them. There were plenty of them that it smells, the odor, Pacoland wants to expand, the residents are against it. There was always something. We were in the limelight all the time.
How many?
And it was not always, instead of really using the name of the company, it would always refer to us personally as a family, the Frankenthals. Frankenthal did this, Frankenthal did that. And it was, like I say, we had lots of other big businesses in Green Bay that I'm sure have problems as well as any business today, or even in those years had problems. But they would use Fort Howard, which was owned by the Coffrin family. They never used the name the Coffrins. But when it came to us, it was Frankenthal. So that's the difference.
How many other meat packing plants were there in Green Bay?
There was Armour & Company and Liebman Packing. Armour & Company, as you know, is a national company. And then there was a small one, Endlich Packing, which really didn't amount to anything. They killed maybe 100 cattle a day. Liebman, they were quite successful. They were quite a large company. Until 1970 or 71, they closed their doors because the original owners were getting very old, and they really had no one to take over their children. They did have children, but I don't know, they did not feel that they were able to continue to do business, so they did close their plant. And when we started, they did try to put us out of business in every way that they could. They tried to hamper every step of the way. At the time when they closed the doors, my husband said, well, maybe someday we will buy the plant. And, well, they tried to sell it to other people. Of course, no one bought it because they were asking a tremendous amount of money for it. To make a long story short, in 73, January of 73, they came, or before that, they came to us in Wheaton, and we purchased it in 1973. And then converted it really from, they were slaughterers as well as processors. So we remodeled the whole plant, built new offices there because the facilities were much larger than, the office space was much larger than what we had at the original plant. So we increased the offices and took out all the killing equipment and used it at our other plants and made it into a processing plant. So we did all the boning there and processing there. And there also is still today a big cold storage facility with it. So we were able to use the whole facilities.
After you killed the cattle, would they then be sold to wholesalers?
Yeah. Wholesalers, processors, people that made sausage. And we did, when we first started, we killed and what you call kill and chill. We would cut the cattle in just in quarters or halves and chip them out that way. But after a couple of years, we processed most of the cattle ourselves. In other words, we boned out the cattle and put them into cuts or into boneless and sell the meat that way instead of selling it as the whole carcass.
Why did you change?
Because it's much more profitable and it's better to sell just the boneless. And then we built a rendering plant where the bones and the offal was processed, used for fertilizer and for fat, which is used for soap, the oils. It separated the fertilizer and the oil, and instead of shipping the whole carcasses, we were able to use all the offal, use it in our rendering plant, we made a much better product. So that's why, and it's why I pay for freight that really is no value to anybody else. So that's the trend today, that to sell carcasses only when you can't, you have no place else to go with it. But if you can bone your cattle and break it down into smaller pieces, it's much better, much more economical all the way around. Do you want some more hot coffee?
No, that's fine.
Let me shut that coffee off.
I wanted to ask about the unions. Did you have a union shop?
We had a union. Not, you wouldn't call it a union shop. We did have a union. We started out what we called the independent union. The employees started their own union. And they were not affiliated with any of the other big unions. But after a while, of course, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters, they wanted to get in because they needed the revenue. So they did finally did succeed, but only at the main plant at Packerline Packing. They're the only ones that really got in. And at our other plants, they always had their own independent union. And when we bought the plant in Chippewa Falls, previous owners was Peter's Meat, and the union really broke them. I think that was one of the reasons that they sold the plant. And anyway, we started out, and after we were there a short time, the union tried to get back in, but we decided that we're going to, if they want to walk out, they walked out. So they did walk out, but we hired other employees, and we ran the plant without a union shop. The unions are fine, but you have no control. You have nothing to say. Unions were fine years ago because when you had the sweatshops, it was a different situation. But today, the unions, they try to run your business, and you have nothing to say. And my husband was very strong, and he just felt that he was going to run the business, not the union wasn't going to run him.
What sort of demands did the union make on your business?
Everything under the sun. And we felt that we paid our employees a very fair wage, and if we made money at the end of the year, we gave them a bonus. Where if you have to pay them a tremendous amount of salary all throughout the year and you're not making any money, you just can't survive. And the way we felt that we would be successful and the employees would be successful is if we had a good year or if we made money, they got the advantage as well as we did, because we paid them a good bonus according to their time that they were there, the kind of performance that they did, and we gave them a big Christmas party. In the summertime, we gave them a big picnic. We treated our employees as good as any company could. That's the way we always felt. We were fair with people. Our door, my husband's door, or when I was in the office, was always open to any employee, that whether he was sweeping the floor or whether he was a butcher, whatever he was doing. And there were many, many people that we helped. They would come with their personal problems. They needed this, they needed that. My husband would never refuse anyone. We were running like a small business loan. If they needed some money, and at times I would say, I'm so sick of keeping additional books. Will you stop it already? He says, they need help. I will help them. If they were a good employee, of course. If they weren't, then it was a different situation. And people even would come to our home. Siggy, I need X dollars. Can you advance me that, or can you give it to me? And he never refused anyone. So as far as the relationship that we had with our employees was excellent. Sure, you had some instigators, some troublemakers, as far as that were trying to get in, that did get in with the union. But on the whole, we really had an excellent relationship with most of our employees.
When did the union come in? Do you remember the date?
In the 60s sometime. I really don't remember what year that they finally... 67, 68... I really don't remember.
Did you have a lot of Jewish employees?
No. None. We had one Jewish man that came to us from another meatpacking plant as a supervisor. But he only stayed with us maybe 6 months, a year. That did not work out. Then we did have another young Jewish later on in the 70s, early 70s, we hired a salesman who was with us, and very bright young man, and he only stayed about 3-4 years. No, though he left after we sold the plant. He was with the company about 5 years. But other than that, there really weren't many Jewish people working, other than our own family. Because in the meat business, most of the Jewish people, either they worked for themselves, had their own business, or they were in the big cities. They didn't really want to go to small towns.
Was your husband at all active in... I know he wasn't active in politics, but was he active in civic?
Yes. Yes, he was very civic-minded. We have supported all the hospitals in Green Bay, the University of Green Bay. We were one of the first supporters of the University of Green Bay when they started. St. Norbert's College, which is a Catholic college in De Pere. As far as supporting the community at large in every way that we could, we did. And of course, as far as the Jewish community was concerned, that was, of course, our first priority. And we've been active, very, very active in UJA. And he was a very generous person. He was not an Orthodox person, but he was very proud of being a Jew and to do whatever he could for his fellow man. And whether, like I said, as far as the Green Bay community itself, we felt that we had to support it as well as the Jewish causes, because this is where we made our living, this is where we got our start, and we owed something to the Green Bay community. So as far as being active in the, he was on on the board of directors for the hospital, St. Vincent's Hospital, and after he passed away, I was on the advisory council for many years, and he was on the board for the University of Green Bay, UWGB, and today my daughter is on the board. So we've been very active in the community as a whole.
How many children do you have?
4. I have a daughter, Betty, and then I have 3 sons, Sheldon, Howard, and Stuart. And they all live in Green Bay, except Stuart, who is second year law school at the University of Louisville.
Are any of them interested in running the business?
No, we sold the business after my husband passed away because, like I told you before, it was just too big. And the children were much younger. You know, it will be 5 years that he's gone. And the only one that works at the plant yet is Sheldon. He has a job at the plant. He was not in an executive position, he was just a worker. And he still works there every day. And Betty is in the real estate business and investments. And Howard is a meat broker. He has his own business in Green Bay. And he still does business with Paco and he sells for them. And when they need a broker, but actually we're not involved in the daily operations at all, you know, of the meat business anymore. Like I said, Stuart goes to law school. What else do I know?
I think that's all the questions that I have. Is there something else that you think?
No, I think it's good to know that people do make a success, even if it's a small town. And let me tell you this, that the people, the farmers that we did business with from the time, the late 30s, when my in-laws came to Green Bay, and until we even went into the packing business, until today yet, even though my husband is no longer here, but my children are here, and even though I don't live in Green Bay, but we had contact with the people. We made friends for many, many years, and still have a good relationship with these people. And one thing, it didn't make any difference to either my husband or to me, or even to my children. From what we started with, we were poor, we had nothing. But even though we have become more or less a success story, because we did build a business, which is unusual for someone. My husband had 1 year high school education, never went to school or anything. And I just graduated from high school. I had no really college education. We still are friends today with the same people that we were 30, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, that our relationship has not changed in any form or way. So I think that's the thing that's good, and that makes me feel good, that I feel I'm no better than the next one. Money does not mean anything to me. Sure, it's nice to have. You can buy material things, but your personality is what counts, and you really have to be a mensch, or a person that really understands the next human being, and never forget where you came from. That's the most important thing, that you started out small, and that the next one is just as good, whether they have $5 in their pocket or $10 in their pocket. That doesn't mean anything. That you never forget where you came from. That's the most important thing.
I agree.
See, that's the thing.
When you lived in Green Bay, did you live in a Jewish area?
No. No, that was one of the things that we did when we first were married, yes. But when we decided we had purchased this land, we're close to the plant, which was on the outskirts of Green Bay, and we subdivided that land, and my husband said, oh, let's build a house there. And because at that time, this was in 1959, and he had a barn that was a farm originally, and he was working from there, he said, oh, let's build a house on Deborah Lane. And I said, oh, it's too far away, let's build where there are other Jewish people. because the children started to go to Sunday school, Hebrew school, and I said, this way, if we live far away, if I have to schlep them myself. He says, well, we have the land. If you want a new house, we have the land. The land is paid for. Then this is where we're going to build. It's closer to me for my work. And he won out, and we did build in the area where there were no other Jewish people. I was very sorry, and he was too after several years, because then we decided to go into the packing business and build the plant, and there were lots of problems constantly, you know, with the building. And when we first started, like I told you, the competitors that were in the packing, Liebmans, they tried every which way for us to stop us to go into the business. And there was, at that time, quite a bit of anti-Semitism. And so we were sorry that we did move there. And we were going to sell the house many a times. And then every time we were ready to sell, or we were going to sell, then my husband said, why should I move? If they don't like it, let them move. So we stayed there until after he passed away. Then I did sell the house and I did move away, because I knew we were going to sell the plant, and the house was too big. And then I did move into a condominium where there were more Jewish people in the area. So, but that's about it.
How did the company try to stop you from setting up a meat packing plant?
Well, we, like I told you, we were in the, was a different subdivision, a different township. Was not the city of Green Bay, it was the town of Preble. And we needed sewer, and we needed water, and they tried to block us from getting the water, tried to block us from getting the sewer in. Every obstacle that they could throw our way, they did. When we first started buying cattle, after we opened up, we would send our buyers into the market, the auction markets, and we would give our buyers a certain dollars value that they could pay for the cattle. They would always try to bid us, instead of, we would bid, let's say, 15 cents a pound for the cow, they would bid 16 cents for a cow. It was on an auction type basis, you know, that the cattle were sold, and they tried to stop us in every way. And like I told you, the first year we lost practically everything that we owned. The first 8 months, I should say. And, but thank God we overcame. And we're here. Unfortunately, my husband really worked himself to death, but he had a very bad heart condition, and he had open heart surgery in 1970, so he did live 6.5 years after the surgery, but he sacrificed his life really for the business. And, but that was his whole life. The business was his life. That was his family and his business, and that was it.
Do you know what the other Jews did in Green Bay as far as jobs?
Oh, sure. You had some business people that owned jewelry stores. There were some people that were in the dry goods business. There's the real estate business. There was one big department store, Noss Department Store, which was really a ladies and menswear. There was a paper company. Well, it was really distributor for paper and carpeting, and there were quite a few business people in Green Bay, appliance businesses, you know, in Green Bay. And of course there's people that have jobs too, you know, but people are with Prangies. Today the influx that it has come to Green Bay the younger people, quite a few have gone with the paper mills, which years ago, there really weren't any people with, not to my knowledge, or very, very seldom that there was a Jewish person in the paper business. And we do have quite a few paper mills in Green Bay. But there have been quite a few that are with Fort Howard, with Charmin. There has been quite an influx of young people coming to Green Bay. And even Prangies, years ago, there weren't hardly any Jews there, very, very few. But they have changed their policy. And in fact, one of the vice presidents, he's been there quite some time, is a Jewish man. Most of them have been there for many years. Though the older ones are moving away and have retired to go south or west. So the community has changed quite a bit since, even the last couple of years, since I have left. We have quite an influx of young people that do come. And they stay maybe for 3-4 years, maybe 10 years, I don't know. And then we have quite a few Jewish doctors and dentists. So, it's a nice community.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about the unions. And when, if your employees got sick or if they had an accident in the plant, did you pay for their hospital bill or did you pay sick insurance?
Oh, sure, sure. They had, we had excellent coverage as far as if it was a compensation case, in other words, if they got hurt on the job, which is an entirely different situation, it was a compensation case. If they got sick on their own, we had excellent hospitalization, always the best that you could get. And as far as, let me tell you this, if any of the employees that were executives or in a supervisory personnel, I think we have been the most generous company that I know of anywhere. If someone got sick and was off for a week, two, even months, we paid them their full salary. I know of one case, our engineer, he had open heart surgery. He received his check as if he was working every day. And then he had to have surgery again. When he came back only on a part-time basis, he was paid his full salary the whole time. So I have no regrets or no feeling that I have, or that we, I should say, not I, but that we have cheated anyone out of they got more benefits, I think, by us than any place else.
Did it change more when the union came in?
No, if they were supervisory personnel, they were paid on the same basis, like I said before. But the supervisory personnel was not union to begin with. Mm-hmm. But when the people that were in the union, there were certain conditions, you know, in the contract that if they were sick 1 or 2 days, I mean, they got paid, you know, I mean, and of course, if they made a habit of it, they had to have a doctor's excuse or, you know, a legitimate, that we knew that it was a legitimate thing, you know, but, and as far as the hospitalization, and they had the best that they could get.
Even for the unskilled workers?
Oh, sure.
What would you do if you thought that a worker was cheating or wasn't really sick?
Well, you'd give them a day off or 2 days off. I mean, that was in the contract. But we personally had a superintendent that took care of, or a personnel man that took care of that. I mean, my husband or I could not get involved on a daily basis with each individual employee. You know, there was no way. So we have personnel people that took care of those things. I mean, of course, if somebody took advantage of it and played sick every few weeks, they had so many warnings, they had a warning, and whatever the contract said, and then they eventually, if they would continue, they would be dismissed. But as far as being fair to the employees, we couldn't have been more fair than we were.